Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Robert Fisk, who is the author of a new book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. Robert Fisk is a best-selling author and journalist. He's based in Beirut as a Middle East correspondent for The Independent. He's lived in the Middle East for more than three decades and holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent. So he'll be joining us in a little while. Let's now go to issues in the Middle East with Robert Baer, who is a former CIA officer who ran the Iraq war, or the opposition between the two wars, between Desert Storm and the recent war in Iraq. And he's the author of a book, See No Evil, that's been made into a movie, Syriana, that is coming out soon, starring George Clooney and others. And he also wrote a book about Saudi Arabia called Sleeping with the Devil, How We Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And we'll be talking to him about conditions in the Middle East and the broader strategic mess that this administration has made. And, of course, the president this week tried to deflect his critics of this war. And we'll be talking about the extent to which the president's excuses don't wash. Let's now go to Bob Baer. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, the author of See No Evil, a book that's been made into a movie that's coming out, Syriana, and Sleeping with the Devil, How We Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And I imagine, Robert Baer, you were surprised to see Ahmad Chalabi feted here in Washington last week. I guess in political terms, he's kind of like a Lazarus, is he?
Yes, he has risen from the dead. You know, and this all goes back to the late 80s when his bank in Jordan failed. And according to outside auditors, he was the one that pocketed the money. He lost a couple banks in Beirut as well, defrauded of money. He has, you know, he's of course gone back to Iraq on a U.S. airplane with U.S. troops, which normally would be the worst way to come back to Iraq for an exile. He hadn't been in the country since he was, you know, 8 or 9 years old. He doesn't speak Arabic with an Iraqi accent. And he's pretty much considered as an asset of Iran. When I was with him in northern Iraq in the 90s, he made it very clear to me that he wouldn't be there if it weren't for Tehran and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which would bring him across the border. And he told me very frankly he had to do favors for Iran. You know, he gave them safe houses. He helped their personnel in the north, protected them, paid their electricity. And, of course, you know, once he got to Iraq, he was accused of passing secrets to the Iranians. This is an FBI investigation that's gone nowhere. I'm not surprised about that. But his real paymaster and everything else is in Tehran, so it's ironic that he's showing up at the State Department in the White House in the middle of this war.
And at the American Enterprise Institute as well. So that his neoconservative patrons have not abandoned him, clearly.
No, I mean, when he came from Tehran on this trip, he had just seen the Iranian president, who frankly has blood on his hands, American blood. It's almost some, you know, if you're conspiratorially minded, you'd say this is a huge conspiracy where we're supporting Iran secretly through Chalabi and in Iraq and everything else. Of course, it's not, but what this tells me is that this administration's in deep trouble in Iraq. It's looking for a way out, and the way is Ahmad Chalabi.
Well, Ahmad Chalabi is, of course, the deputy prime minister. He's the oil minister. He has the most important portfolio of all, which is he's in charge of all contracts. So he is powerful in a government that in many ways is irrelevant. At least it's irrelevant to the Sunni minority.
It's irrelevant to the Shia as well, in a sense, in as much as it's independent from the Shia. It's irrelevant to the Kurds, which are a de facto state at this point. And you can't help but miss also the irony that he's in charge of all contracts, over $1 million in charge of the oil contracts. And he's been indicted in several countries for bank fraud.
So was this raid on his house? Because that seemed to have made him, and the fact that he was able to go from being an American puppet to being sort of castigated by his former patrons. That's the explanation for his Lazarus-like reemergence, is that that raid backfired. So
it did backfire. I think the raid was conducted on very legitimate grounds. There was evidence that someone in Washington was passing him secrets, and he was passing them on to Tehran. I don't think they would have made this raid if they didn't have conclusive proof of that. I just know the way this administration in Iraq works. I think more than just the raid, which was important, you know, to reburnish his Iraqi credentials, but the fact is that the Iranians have found somebody they can work with who they now can claim is really a Washington creation, or, if you like, a compromise. And this is probably the best explanation of how he came back, is he's a man of compromise.
But another explanation might be that since there seems to be dueling foreign policies here, Pentagon interests versus state and CIA, do you see perhaps the hand of Dick Cheney in this, in terms of you know, rescuing this guy and keeping him going?
Well, I think the only reason is probably Cheney. If it had been left up to the CIA or State Department, we would cut this guy loose, and we would have insisted that he not be Deputy Prime Minister, have nothing to do with distributing the $20 billion of contracts which we've given to Iraq. That's a lot of money, and a lot of money to build a political party. But the neocons are just not going to admit defeat in Iraq.
But they're also talking about going after Iran. And at a strategic level, we have handed the most valuable part of Iraq over to Iran. That's where most of the oil is. They are the beneficiaries so far. The reason that we're fighting the Sunni and that the Shia are keeping their powder dry is that we're busily knocking off their enemies. So it's as though we've bought front row tickets to a civil war. And where the only reason it hasn't broke out into the open in full-scale war is that we're doing the Shiites' dirty work.
We are doing Iran's dirty work. In particular, this is a war they've been fighting for, more than 1,000 years against the Semitic Arabs, the Iranians, who were... and we've done their bidding in Iraq. We've handed them the oil region in the south, where most of the oil comes from. We've put the Shia in power by one man, one vote democracy. We've removed Saddam. We've done exactly what they wanted to. So maybe people in Washington are hoping that we can reach some grand compromise with Iran now, and the compromise would be is not to go nuclear.
This is a country whose leader just called for Israel to be wiped off the face of the map.
That's a slight fact that's gotten in the way of their reality. But they have never been reality-based. So maybe they're just going to overlook it or pretend it doesn't exist. Remember, Ahmadinejad was clearly involved in an assassination of a Kurdish leader in Vienna. He was involved in kidnapping of Americans in Lebanon in the 80s when I was there. He's a member of the Quds Force, which is what we would describe as a terrorist group. Was the spearhead of the Islamic Revolution throughout the Middle East. It founded Hezbollah in the mid-80s. And they don't know what they have. It just, the neocons all along had claimed that, just let democracy flower in Iran and we're going to get some pro-Western government. Which, of course, that didn't happen because they weren't dealing with facts. And the facts in Iran is you've got a bad economy and they've elected this very devout millennialist Shia leader who's also a terrorist.
But in effect, what we've got now, and if there isn't any explanation for this blunder, this what people like Bill Odom and others call the biggest strategic blunder in American history, what Zbigniew Brzezinski calls suicidal statecraft, if what we've created now is in effect a surrogate war with the Iranians backing the Shia, who now are in control, and the rest of the Gulf and Jordan and the Arab and the Saudis backing the Sunni, we may be in for something bigger here, aren't we, than just a failed state.
If you're forced to make a bet on this, I'd say the conflict is going to spread. You look at Jordan. Four Iraqis were involved in these suicide attacks. They're from Anbar province. All their names are tribes, people that traditionally are not involved in terrorism. The tribes of Iraq have been fairly conservative, partially Bedouin. And the fact that they are blowing themselves up in Amman to defend the Sunni, as they say, tells me that this is a wider conflict. And the chances of it spreading to Syria and Lebanon are high, and the chances of it spreading into Saudi Arabia, seeing worse violence, are very high. So I think it is suicidal, this whole war in Iraq, in that 60 to 70% of our oil resources, proven oil resources, are on the Persian Gulf. And we've put them in jeopardy.
Well, oddly enough, the president pushed back this week from his critics and said that, in a sense, and so did Dan Bartlett, his spokesperson, said that we can't allow Iraq to be handed over to killers like Zarqawi and bin Laden. Well, the irony, of course, is that George Bush's mistake has become our problem all of a sudden, and he's saying we can't afford to cut and run. But this is a problem of our own making. As far as I know, bin Laden and Zarqawi weren't in Iraq until we created the conditions that they are feasting off.
Yeah, and they lied about it. They clearly lied about it, the connections between Saddam and bin Laden. And, you know, it's like having a drunken, incompetent surgeon who's gone in and botched the whole job and is saying, well, we can't stop now. I mean, in a sense, he's right. What do we do? But the problem is we cannot win the war in Iraq. We have created a division between the Sunni and the Shia, which can only get worse. And probably U.S. troops are making it worse faster. But, you know, keep in mind that most of the oil in the Persian Gulf is controlled by ethnic Shia. They, you know, Saudi Arabia, the eastern province, Shia control that area. Bahrain is majority Shia. The Kuwaitis are approaching majority Shia.
I mean, they don't so much control, but geographically, are the majority in that region. So
they occupy the territory, but their capacity for causing trouble is very high.
Right. And that's, of course, what you pointed out in your book, Sleeping with the Devil, how we sold our soul for Saudi crude, that one terrorist group, with a mortar, could lob a shell into a key pumping station, and the whole, suddenly we're all getting our bicycles out and buying candles.
You and I could go to Saudi Arabia today and fire a rocket-propelled grenade into a pipeline, do minimum damage, but the risk premium would be $10 to $20 a barrel of oil, and you know that's going to send us up to $4 or $5 for a gallon of gasoline, at least for a short term. That's the kind of the fragility we're facing in this region.
So I guess then, just in terms of foreign policy analysis, our blundering has made this fragility more tenuous. And is there any way to I mean, the before we went in there, the world looks like a lot better place, doesn't it?
Oh, we're a lot worse off today, having gone into Iraq, because the fact is that our military is put in the position of slaughtering Sunni Arabs. And across the Middle East, and we've seen the Jordanian attacks, Sunni Arabs look at the war in Iraq as an attack on them, and they will respond. Now, I can't tell you how they're going to respond. This is an evolving process, but they will respond.
So, again, we may be forcing them to choose up sides. I mean, if the Iranians this army that we're training, that all of the administration people keep telling us is our way out, our exit strategy, is when we stand down, they stand up. But they are an entirely Shiite and Kurdish army.
Exactly. Well, that's a big lie. We're not creating a national army. We're taking the Kurdish and Shia militia and arming and training them which will only make things worse at the end of the day.
So that means that if, when the civil war begins, and you know, obviously it's already begun, but when it breaks out into the open, the Shia will have the initial advantage because of their Iranian sponsorship and the fact that our side stupidly have trained them. But surely the Sunni will step in. The Saudis and the Jordanians and others won't allow their patrons to be overrun.
This is exactly what's happening today. You have the Iraqis have come out and said the majority of suicide bombers in Iraq are Saudis. The Saudis, indirectly or directly, are sending these people into Iraq. Whether it's the rich merchants or the intelligence ministry, it really doesn't matter. But they're looking at these suicide bombers as self-defense, in a sense, the Saudis are. And, you know, publicly they support the United States and against terrorism and the rest of them, but they are supporting these people.
And Condoleezza Rice was just there, and she apparently tried to talk to the Shias into giving the Sunni a little more, and They don't want to budge. I mean, there's the bitterness there is just unbelievable.
The bitterness goes back to 680 AD when they killed the Shia Imam Hussein, and this is the kind of conflict they're fighting. They are not fighting for democracy. Those are our values, not theirs. You know, and the Sunni look at the Shia as heretics, and their view of them is getting worse by the day, and as the conflict continues. So this is by no means over.
So there's no way, just in closing, Robert Baer, that you can inject any kind of conspiratorial framework to this. It's not as if some devious people in a back room figured out what a brilliant idea will create a civil war in the Middle East.
No, I know these people, and they are true believers, and they truly believe that putting our troops on the ground in Iraq would cause the spread of democracy. I mean, you see this in the New York Times and the Washington Post on the op-ed page as well, but these are people who have never been to the Middle East.
Well, unfortunately, they're still in control. And there's a totally feckless opposition in this country that allowed this catastrophe to happen.
The Democrats went along with it. They didn't question this intelligence, and neither did the press. There are a bunch of Iraqi people have dealt with in Iraq for a long time. They never called me and thought, could sway anybody, but, I mean, people like me would have warned them. Scowcroft tried and failed.
Well, not only did they, but, I mean, the difference is here that the administration actually pushed the most bogus stuff. The aluminum tubes that Condoleezza Rice tried to sell were just patently ridiculous. Anybody that knows anything about centrifuges know that there's no way that 122-millimeter rocket casings having to do with centrifuges. The Niger documents, which were forged, and there's possibly a link to the neocons in terms of the forgery circulating it through the Italians. So,
what about torturing the Qaeda prisoners until they admitted a connection with Saddam? And they basically tortured this information out of them to support the administration's position.
Well, and then you've got curveball. So I'm giving you the menu that was sold to us, and it's all so patently tawdry and false that it's breathtaking. So I don't know how the administration can tell us that we weren't lied to.
No, we were lied to. I mean, the more I couldn't believe it myself, but the more evidence I've seen, the facts, and we were clearly misled into this war.
I thank you very much for joining us. And by the way, congratulations on Syriana.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It's quite wonderful. It's a very lyrical piece of work.
Yeah. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Robert Baer, who was the CIA officer in charge of the Iraqi opposition in the north of Iraq between Operation Desert Storm and the current Iraq war. He's written two bestsellers, See No Evil, which has been made into this movie, Syriana, that's coming out, and Sleeping with the Devil, How We Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. I'm now speaking with Robert Fisk, who has joined me in the studio. He's a best-selling author and journalist based in Beirut, and as the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, he's lived in the Middle East for almost three decades and holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent, and his new book is The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. And Robert Fisk, in terms of conquest in the Middle East, we just got through talking about how we've already lost the war in Iraq.
Yeah, well, the title is ironic. The war is finished. It's over for us. The American project is over. What's amazing when you go in and out of Baghdad, as I still do, in and out of Iraq, is the way in which there are these two levels of reality. There's one where, for example, I'm on the floor of the central mortuary counting corpses, 26 by lunchtime one Monday, looking at the computer, which tells me that 1,100 Iraqis died by violence in Baghdad in July alone. This was in August I did this. This is in central Baghdad, actually there among corpses with flies all over them. And then you come to Washington or L.A. or London and Paris, and you hear people say, well, things are getting better. There's democracy. It's a new beacon of freedom in the Middle East. And the U.S. administration, like the British government of our own dear Tony Blair, have totally lost track of reality. From Mosul and Kirkuk and, to some extent, Erbil in the north on the edge of Kurdistan, right down to Basra. It is anarchy, chaos, insurgency, tribal warfare, armed men on the streets. There is no control by the Americans or British anymore, except in their own little crusader-like fortresses on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates. It's over.
And at the strategic level, people like General Odom and Scowcroft and the former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski just describes this suicidal statecraft. At the strategic level, we appear to have handed over the most valuable part of Iraq, where the oil is, to the Shiites. We have this roiling insurgency on the Sunni side, and our soldiers are essentially fighting the Shia civil war for them by beating up on them. And I imagine if political pressure continues on President Bush from the Republicans who are running again next year, they're already saying we might lose. So is it likely that there will be a troop withdrawal, and the minute the Americans step out of the crossfire, then the Sunni and the Shia engage in full-scale civil war?
I don't think so. Look, there never has been a civil war in Iraq. The line pushed by the American spokesman, both in civilian and military political terms, has always been that we've got this Iraq that's divided up between the Kurds in the north and the Sunnis in the middle and the Shiites in the south. And the Kurds and the Shiites have the oil, and therefore we're splitting it up. And if we leave, there will be civil war. Over and over again, it started in 2003 with the American spokesman Dan Senor, who said they were worried about civil war if the Americans left. I remember I was sitting in the press conference saying, what? What are we doing warning Iraq of civil war? I didn't hear this from any Iraqis. You know, a few months ago, I was at the funeral of a Sunni Muslim doctor in Baghdad who'd been murdered by a gang of gunmen, almost certainly Shia Muslims, in his surgery. Almost certainly because I'm sure they were Shia who killed him, almost certainly because he objected to the building of a new mosque at the end of his road. And afterwards, I was sitting on the floor of the home at the funeral feast next to the brother of the doctor who'd been killed, who of course was a Sunni. And I said to him, so will there be civil war? He said, why do you Westerners always want us to have civil war? He said, we're not a sectarian society. We're a tribal society. We're intermarried. My wife is a Shiite. He said, do you want me to kill my wife? And this is a real Iraqi voice. This isn't someone at the State Department or the Pentagon mouthing off as a spokesman. And you know, the Shiites have shown great restraint. They have not retaliated largely for the attacks on them. Somebody wants a civil war in Iraq. I don't think most of the Sunnis I talked to there, including those in the famous Sunni triangle, which is actually a rectangle, I hate to spoil the cliche, they don't say they want to kill all the Shiites. There is clearly an institution of some form in Iraq which wants a civil war or wants people to feel frightened of a civil war. And certainly the constant repetition by the U.S. administration, to some extent the Blair government, absolutely the American military, and to some considerable extent American journalists, gives the impression to me that we want to threaten the Iraqis with civil war to make them more obedient to our wishes, i.e. if we go, if you don't do what we want, just think of what's going to happen to your families in your country. We didn't do this when we invaded. We were coming to liberate them. Now we want to stay on there to prevent them killing themselves. That wasn't also part of the plan we put forward at the time. And now we're there because allegedly, I was listening to Bing West, who was participating as an American soldier officer in the third liberation of Fallujah last November. And he said at the Council on Foreign Relations a few days ago in New York, I was there speaking with him, oh, well, you know, the Sunnis have got to learn they've got to have a democracy. And if they don't learn that, they'll continue to be occupied by Iraqi troops, most of whom are Shiites. I mean, what a way to start a sectarian war than saying that and doing that. And I said, you know, to the audience, I said, I quoted the Duke of Wellington at Waterloo about the British Army. I said, I don't know if you frighten the enemy, but by God, you frighten me.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Robert Fisk, the author of a new book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. And Robert Fisk lived in the Middle East for almost three decades. He holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent. And he is, as you mentioned, he's been in Iraq quite a lot. So given that we are that the president, you know, obviously the president's mistake has become our problem, and just recently this week, he pushed back against his critics, saying that essentially that we can't afford to lose, as did Dan Bartlett, his spokesperson, and that we can't turn Iraq over to killers like Zarqawi and bin Laden, who, by the way, weren't there before we went in there, and that the so here we are training an army that president says when the army, the Iraqi army stands up, we stand down. Well, the Iraqi army is almost entirely Shia and Kurd. So just walk us through a scenario then. If it's not a civil war, what's it going to be?
Well, the first thing is that the U.S. administration at some point is going to endure some disaster in Iraq, which is going to force them to admit, to fess up that it's not working. At that point, there are going to have to be some form of mediation people step forward. Now, who they can be, I don't know. I mean, the United Nations got blown up in Baghdad. The International Red Cross got blown up in Baghdad. It's a bit like the French with the Algerian War in the early 60s when they were looking everywhere for what the French call the interlocuteur valable, the middleman. It turned out the French had actually murdered most of them already, so it wasn't a very good chance of getting out until the Evian Agreement of 62. But, you know, I think that we've got to realize that to get out, the Americans need the help of Syria and Iran. So instead of beating up on Syria and Iran, I think pretty soon they're going to be a little bit more accommodating to these not very pleasant regimes, let's speak frankly. They're going to need the help of the clerics of both the Shiite and the Sunni community, therefore the Association of Ulamas, which I've been seen where you have serious, grown-up, mature, reasonable imams and clerics of both major religious communities on the Islamic side. And they're going to have to talk to the leaders of the Iraqi side of the insurgency, not al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda don't want to talk to the Americans, and Americans don't want to talk to al-Qaeda. It'll be up to the future Iraq to deal with the al-Qaeda side of it, not us. We're not going to root out al-Qaeda and all this other material from the rear end of a bullet we keep hearing about. But at the end of the day, they are going to talk to the insurgency leaders. I met three of them, including the man who commanded the insurgents in Fallujah in November, in the battle where the city was very largely destroyed and certainly very badly damaged. I met three of them in a neighboring country, not Syria, Jordan, actually. And they walked into the room, and one of them, the first guy who came in, he was referred to as a general.
Was he a Baathist?
He would have been once, but whether he still is now, he's a businessman, among other things, but he's also a general. He held out his hand and said, "Oh, Mr. Robert, we meet again." And I said, "Hang on a minute, I've never seen you before." He said, "Oh, yes, you have." He said, "In 1980, when we invaded Iran, you were under fire on the front line of the Iraqi side near Basra, and I took the first tanks across the Karen River. I was a lieutenant colonel, and you climbed on my tank and you interviewed me. I got back to Beirut and went through my files, all on paper, right, no computers. And there he was. I did indeed interview him with his real name. And what's quite clear, you see, is it's the junior officers, the colonels and the majors, of the Iran-Iraq war, a war which Saddam pursued relentlessly for 8 years at a cost of 1.5 million lives. At our wish, we supported him. We gave him helicopters. We gave him photo reconnaissance pictures. We turned our blind eye at the gassing of tens of thousands of Iranians. We got upset about the Kurds later on for different political reasons. And these are the people who are really fighting the insurgency against the Americans. The suicide bombers, who largely but not entirely are more of the al-Qaeda persuasion, are just a little extra accretion. But what we don't realize, I mean, you were talking about intelligence just now, and it was, you know, they deliberately manipulated the intelligence. Before the invasion, the U.S. administration, deliberately or otherwise, ignored clear intelligence that was available to all of us. For example, and this is in my book, I got a list, a long tract of everything bin Laden has said on video audio since 2001, September 11. 5 weeks before the invasion, he put out an audio tape in which he said that Muslims in Iraq should hide their weapons before this is the invasion, and that for the Muslims of Iraq, he meant people who were sympathetic Sunni to him, Salafist, Wahhabi, it was in their interest to have an alliance, he said, with the socialists. He said socialists, he meant the Ba'ath Party, of course, and the Iraqi army. Socialists remain infidels, but it is in our interest to be associated with them in this battle against the new Crusaders. And he said, actually, at the time of the real Crusades, we're talking about 11th, 12th century, the followers of the Prophet, he said, made an alliance with the Persians, who were not Muslims then, they were Zoroastrians, against the Crusaders, and it did them no harm. Mm. In the same case, an alliance now with the socialists is in our interest. So that was the moment. That was the detonation of the resistance to come. And nobody read it. All the Pentagon asked, or CIA asked, was, is it him? Is that Bin Laden's voice? Is he alive? How long ago did you make the tape? And that's all the journalists did. I missed it too. But there was the information that was telling us what was going to happen afterwards, and we didn't even read it.
No, I remember that fatwa or a missive, whatever you want to call it, where he talked about the socialist apostates. But in terms of the bitterness, you say that it's a Western obsession, the idea of a civil war, and the Iraqis themselves are always surprised that we seem so obsessed with it. While that is true, the military officers that you talk about, these junior officers that fought against Iran, on the other side, apparently, the Barda Brigade, which was an Iranian surrogate army of Iraqis, ran the prison camps and tortured these guys. So you can't discount the bitterness that exists between a lot of these Sunni officers and the Shiites.
No, there are clearly death squads of both Sunnis and Shia, divided death squads existing in Baghdad.
Right.
I mean, of the 26 bodies brought to the central mortuary one Monday in August by midday, most of them had been executed. There was a woman with her hands tied behind her back, shot three times in the head. There was a baby shot in the face. I mean, this is very, very savage stuff. But you know, you've got to remember that the Shiites were most of the Iraqi army under Saddam, and they went on fighting the Iranians for all those 8 years, despite the repeated demands by Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran for them to turn sides and turn over against their officers and fight on the Iranian side. But again, you know, you have to realize that the Iranians are in the Iraqi government, Dawa Party and Skiri, which are in the Iraqi government, which are negotiated with by the Americans. They talk to them. Mm-hmm. The Dawa Party was responsible for the kidnapping of the Westerners in Beirut in the 80s. The Dawa Party blew up the U.S. and French embassies in Kuwait. They tried to kill the emir of Kuwait. This is now the elected party with whom we negotiate.
Right, these are the guys that Oliver North tried to swap out.
Indeed, yes, yeah. Of course. And you know, over and over again, we are accepting the narrative of history laid down by our masters, by Bush and Blair and some of our most prominent journalists, yours and mine.
Yeah, but Robert, are these people incompetent? That's what I'm trying to get at, what I was talking to Bear about.
Your government, you mean?
Yeah, are these people, is there some plan that we're missing here? Because it seems to be an unbelievable screw-up that's just getting worse.
Look, there's two things I learned in Iraq over the last 3 years, and I've been going there since 1978, so I had a lot of Iraq under the Saddamists and the Baathists. We obviously went there because of oil. If the chief export, the principal export of Iraq was asparagus or carrots, we would not have the 82nd Airborne in Mosul, and we wouldn't have the 3rd Infantry Division in Baghdad, full stop. But I was on Highway 8 south of Baghdad some months ago when the ground began. I was investigating a murder of a Red Cross guy, and the ground began to shake underneath me. And up the road, powering up with all this huge exhaust fumes, was the biggest military convoy I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, Humvees, M1A1 Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, truck after truck, tens of thousands of troops. Biggest military movement. It was the rule of them on, they're changing over divisions since World War II. And it took 4.25 hours for this Armageddon-like beast to pass me. 155mm artillery, light artillery, vast trucks containing container trucks containing concrete fabrications for underground bases for protection from bombs and shelling, all going up into the wilderness of occupation, and an Apache helicopter, these giant rodents over the top, extraordinary scene. And squatting by the side of the road with a Iraqi family I was interviewing, I watched this and watched it, and I suddenly realized, it was a bit late in the day, I guess, that superpowers who make very bad peacekeepers have an almost visceral need to project military strength, and they have to go on projecting strength to remain a superpower. And, you know, 2,000 years ago, a little bit to the west, if I'd been a reporter, I'd been watching the Roman legions tramping by on their way to Syria, and disaster, by the way, in the Syrian desert. Battle of Carrhae. they chopped off the head of the Roman commander and sent it back to Rome. Same kind of situation. And we need to acknowledge that. I mean, Iraqis will ask you, well, Iraqi asked me in August, he said, you know, the Americans are in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Turkey, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Algeria, near Taman Rasset, the southern Algerian desert. They're in Oman. They're in Yemen. Special forces again. They're in Qatar. They're in Bahrain, headquarters of the American fleet. They're still in parts of Saudi Arabia. They're in Kuwait. They're almost down to the Somali border. Why are they there? He asked me, what are they doing? In fact, if you go to the far north and start at the ice cap, they're in Greenland, Iceland, Britain, Germany, they're in Yugoslavia now, Italy, Greece, and then you join up with the Turkish bit. There's a new Iron Curtain from the frosts of the north down to Central Africa. What's it for? Now, when you look at it from that point of view, it isn't just a question, oh, is it a screw-up in Iraq? There's a much bigger picture to look at. Why are you there?
Right, but there's a big difference between intentions and execution. And that's what I'm trying to get at, Robert Fisk, is you know, you're talking about this giant military machine that's there setting up bases, et cetera. Mm. But it's also every day the elephant is being bitten by the mosquito, the IEDs. I mean, you know, they left open those huge munition warehouses where they, which the IAEA identified because of this explosive that was just used in the same explosive, by the way, that was just used in the bombings in Jordan. So they have unlimited supplies of the best explosives, thanks to our incredible incompetence not securing that.
Look, I think there's a whole series of things here. If you're saying, you know, was there a long-term plot behind Iraq, we've obviously got to ask the question, who benefits most within the Middle East of the breakup and effectively the destruction of what was the most powerful Arab state, Iraq? Well, the Israelis obviously benefit. Israel was among perhaps the only Middle East state that existed, with the exception of Kuwait and maybe Kurdish people in Kurdistan, that supported this whole wretched war from the start. Couldn't have it soon enough, as one Israeli general said. If breaking up the Arab world in this way, it has to increase the, quote, security, unquote, of Israel to see this very powerful Arab state, which has both water and oil. It's the only Arab state that has both water and oil, Iraq, taken to pieces. And we can go back again, the neoconservatives, their support for Netanyahu in the time of Clinton, how they put together this package of invasion of Iraq back then. But I think the other thing is, it's the inability of the US in particular, and the British now, to actually think things through. I mean, in 1941, Winston Churchill, at the time when we still expected the Nazi Wehrmacht to invade southern England, Churchill set up a committee to organize the Allied government of occupied post-war Germany 4 years before it happened. In 1941, we were still waiting for a German invasion, but we were already had a committee planning the aftermath of the war in Germany, occupied by us. We were going to win. Nobody planned the aftermath of the Iraq war till about 3 days before the invasion. Even then, no one looked at the plans. Now, when you work like that, you will screw it up. You will end up in an act of folly, which is exactly what's happened. And all we're waiting for now is the next calamity, which will push eventually the Blairs and the Bushes into admitting things seem to have gone wrong. I suspect what's going to happen, and I'm seeing this in the letters columns of some American papers, and it's beginning to leach across into editorials, is going to be the line, the Iraqis don't deserve us. We gave them everything they could possibly want, and they don't deserve us. And then we'll start producing the image of the generically violent Arab people of Iraq. And of course, if they then do have a civil war, or we provoke a civil war by setting Shiites against Sunnis, then we say, look, we told you so. We did everything we could. They're not up to it. And that will be the get out. We did our best.
Well, but just in following through what you just said, Robert Fisk, in terms of the implying that the neocons, the Israelis conned the neocons into sucking.
I didn't say that.
Well.
I said the neocons were trying to con the U.S. administration, perhaps with Israel in mind. I didn't say the Israelis lay behind it. They didn't.
Okay, so but assuming that there is somebody behind the scenes is actually thinking this through rather than this, you know, just being a result of absolute, you know, faith-based foreign policy ideology and rampant incompetence. From the Israeli point of view, I can't see how this situation is benefiting them. By the way, the Israelis just apparently have been suggesting that they're not too thrilled with the idea of toppling the Assad regime because they're not sure that
They might not get a Sunni Muslim regime instead. They're quite
they
right
may,
about
they
that.
May
the Israelis
a,
are quite right, yeah.
They may get a fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood regime. And if this situation continues to deteriorate in Iraq, it's likely that we could have a roiling mess that will go through Jordan and Lebanon and into the West Bank. So the Israelis will end up with an entire Arab, roiling Arab world on their West Bank. So I can't see how that could be in their security interests.
No, but you see, the Israelis didn't predict what would happen after the war any more than the Americans did. Although, actually, we journalists, certainly in Europe, French, Italian, British journalists, we were saying quite specifically that this was insanity, that this would end up in chaos and anarchy. Long before this invasion, I was writing in Independent. They won a democracy in the Middle East, in Iraq.
Right.
You know, and we were talking about what would happen in this society, which is a very educated society, or certainly was until sanctions really began to bite after the 1990 invasion of Kuwait. These people, you know, the Iraqis know what's going on. They know all about war. They know much more about war than the U.S. military do. They fought an eight-year war. There's no American around now in any ordinary combat position who's ever done that. There's some generals from Vietnam, of course. And I think that, you know, clearly there were various factors. There's the oil factor. There's the need of all superpowers to expand, like the British Empire, the Roman Empire. There's the Israeli factor. Clearly, Israel's friends in the administration were not blind to what might have been the advantages for Israel in effectively cutting up and chopping up the most well-armed, largest and most powerful Arab state. I mean, largest in terms of power, not in terms of geographical area. And we have on top of that all the various accretions of the Blair government and the European Union, the decisions over whether or not to support America, the degree to which it was an ideological war, you know, God told me to invade Iraq and so on and so forth, and the degree to which also the failure to find bin Laden led viscerally again to the need to find someone else to bring down and declare a victory over. I gave a lecture in New York, must be well over a year ago now, in which I asked the audience if they knew when the moment came after September 11, 2001, when Osama bin Laden's face was faded off the television screen and Saddam's was brought up. And a New York professor wrote me a letter about, I got about a month later, a real letter because I don't use the email, as you know. And it said that he'd gone through The Washington Post, the LA Times, and New York Times references. And there was a clear moment when Osama bin Laden faded away and bin Laden came up as the new beast figure. And it coincided precisely with the Enron scandal.
Well, there may be something to that. I mean, obviously they...
Well, that's what he said. Yeah,
they went after Saddam because he had an address. And I guess Rumsfeld himself said about the Afghan war, they don't have any good targets, but they got good targets in Iraq. And they obviously destroyed every target they could find in Afghanistan. The other group that you didn't mention in who benefited and who lost and what the motives were about getting into this disaster in Iraq, of course, the only people who are tangibly benefiting from this catastrophe are the contractors. And this is a new phenomenon.
The Saudis are as well.
The Saudis
are. They're making a lot of money out of this.
Yeah.
Because not only are they able effectively to control the price of oil, but they're also exporting their oil into Iraq, which potentially holds the largest oil reserves in the world.
I know. Well, there's always been a suspicion that it was always been in the Saudis' interest to keep Iraqi oil off the market. And that's you've got to admit, the Iraqi oil's been off the market since about 1990, right?
Well, no, Iraqi oil was coming out under the Food for Oil program.
Right,
it was going out illegally also to Syria and Jordan. But
nothing like this capacity that it's capable.
No, nothing. It's the Saudis and Kuwaitis who've principally benefited, just as the Kuwaitis principally lost during the 1990 invasion.
But this phenomenon that we have now with contractors who have a direct access to the United States Treasury, these aren't appropriated. Through
uncontrolled and direct access.
Yeah, because it's not appropriated. It's not voted on. And apparently, I talk to soldiers in the theater who come back, and they say that we're there, us, you know, the boys and girls in uniform, are there essentially to protect the contractors.
No, that's not correct. The contractors are now protecting the boys and girls in uniform. Many of the American bases are now protected by mercenaries. Let's not use this word contractors. Armed civilian contractors are mercenaries, whether they be from South Africa, former Special Forces, former British SAS, members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary in Belfast, Protestants only for the large part, I've noticed. These people are now an army without rules, of engagement, who have no serious controls over them, who through various financial benefits, I mean, many of them are getting more than $1,000 a day.
I know.
And this is your money, not mine. Yeah. And these people now are making up their own rules as they go along. You see them in the streets. Many Iraqis don't have contact with U.S. forces anymore. They just have contact with these large guys with dripping with all kinds of weapons you haven't seen before, wearing shades, of course, who are bullying them off the streets and wanting to shoot them if they get too near. I mean, contractors, mercenaries have killed innocent Iraqis. We don't even hear about it. We don't care about Iraqis. That's one of the points. That's why we don't give the casualty figures out for Iraqis.
Well, by the way, if they get killed, they're not counted as casualties too. So it works both ways.
But they do have we do have names and addresses, which we don't have for Iraqis.
Right. But, I mean, it's another way to keep the overall death toll down on the American side.
Because
we know the Pentagon is lying about the number of wounded. It's two or three times. One in four coming in and out of that theater has checked in for medical and psychological problems.
I think they play around with the psychological side of it, saying, well, that's not actually a war wound in the sense it doesn't have blood and scratched skin, etc. But I think that, the mercenary problem is that there are an awful lot of murders taking place in Iraq now, which is what we'd call them if we had a proper police force and law and justice, which we're not offering the Iraqis at the moment. And justice is what the Middle East needs, by the way. Before it needs democracy, it wants justice. You build democracy on justice. But these people are out of control. And there's no because Americans cannot be put before Iraqi courts, and Paul Bremer, second U.S. proconsul, saw to that, there is no attempt to control them. And in places like, for example, the Green Zone, the mercenaries are principally in charge of the defense of the Green Zone. And in certain bases up the Tigris River, mercenaries protect the U.S. troops in their bases. That's the reality of Iraq.
Well, just this week at an event, Evan Wright, this young American author who wrote Generation Kill, who was a Marine who went in with the invasion.
The initial invasion, yeah.
The initial invasion. He was lamenting the fact that nobody's ever told the Iraqi side of the story, which is not true because Anthony Shadid wrote a book about the Iraqi side of the story. But the point's well taken.
It's fine in there as well in my book. There's quite a lot of...
Yeah. But in principle, it's absolutely true that we only talk about our side, not about what we're doing to the country. But Evan Wright made the point. He said, if you look what happened down in New Orleans with Katrina, the catastrophe that was wrought here on our own shores by nature, imagine Katrina all over Iraq. He basically said, we went in there and we smashed that country. Mm-hmm. And it is broken and it is in ruins and it's not working. So just expand on that, if you will, about how, you know, it sort of harkens back to the only warning apparently that President Bush got from anybody in his circle, from Colin Powell, saying if you, if you break it, you own it, the so-called pottery barn analogy of foreign policy. But isn't that really at the heart of the problem? Is that the truth of the matter is that the Iraqis actually were better off under Saddam?
Well, it depends whether you like security and dictatorship or freedom and anarchy. If you have a family and you have kids and they're in danger of being kidnapped for money or shot dead, whatever their age is, or you have a wife who's in danger of being kidnapped for sexual slavery or money, and you don't have enough money to buy gasoline, to run a generator, to keep your fridge with fresh food or have air conditioning and heat, you will look back, and they do look back, with some fond memories of the horrible Saddam regime. They are now associating our version of freedom with anarchy. And they're right to make that association because that's what we've brought them. We've brought them anarchy. And from that very first day when I saw the Library of Qurans burning and the smashing
up. You mean on the 14th April?
Yep, yeah, absolutely. And the smashing up and theft from the National Museum of Antiquities in Baghdad, and then the burning of the entire infrastructure of Iraq, every ministry, with the exception of the two whom the Americans guarded, which was oil and the interior ministry, of course. It was quite obvious that a pattern of anarchy had been set for the future of Iraq. And it doesn't matter how many referendums on constitutions and democratic elections you go through. Once you allow a country to fall out of control, armed men will take it over. And they have. Iraq is now under the control of tribal armed men, Shiite militias, insurgents. You can mix them up in various forms or say, what is Muqtada Saleh going to do, etc. Iraq is lost to us. It's finished.
It is, and that's what I keep hearing, and that's what Bob Baer was saying. But you're saying that the civil war is not inevitable. But if the country's broken, and if we're basically our guys are sort of hunkered down, either protecting themselves or being protected by the mercenaries. You can't rebuild a country while you're being shot at, and clearly nobody's rebuilding this place. And it's been shattered and broken. We know the political pressure that the Republicans are under to show some signs of progress when there are none. So there'll be pressure in as the 06 elections get close for some kind of cosmetic withdrawal. So to me, I'm just trying to walk us through what is likely to happen here, because if we've already lost and we're whistling past the graveyard, how's it going to play out? It seems to
I'll give you an example of how. I was down in Canberra launching my book in Australia a couple of weeks ago, and I had dinner with a number of military officers, and they began talking about the need to double the size of the Australian army. I said, what? You're not at war? What the hell are you talking about? And they were very frank about it. They said that, look, America has lost a war in Iraq. If it pulls out of Iraq, which it will, American power is going to be considerably diminished around the world, and the United States may not any longer have an interest in looking after the Pacific, that part of the Pacific. He said, we've got a country called Indonesia, a Muslim country to the north of Australia, and they could be in Sydney in 24 hours. We've got to start looking after ourselves and no longer thinking that there is a military dependence upon the United States. Now, that is a sort of long-term effect that's going to happen. I was shocked by this. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, Australia is a vast desert surrounded by a little bit of green where people live, here was an army thinking of doubling its size because of events in Iraq, even though Australia is 18 hours flying time from Iraq. That's the kind of ripple effect that the American withdrawal probably will have, and they will withdraw. They will leave.
So in other words, the Bush administration have turned the American military into a paper tiger.
Well, they're not a paper tiger. If you go to Fallujah and Ramadi and see what the American military have done, the last person who told me they were a paper tiger was Osama bin Laden, by the way. I think he got it wrong. And he said that directly to me, and I said, whoop, hold on a second, you know. I think that the American military is being torn to pieces by this war, because not just in question in terms of, you know, people joining up and reservists not wanting to, you know, become reservists anymore and actually damaging what is meant to be a professional army. But I think the same damage is being done to the morale of the U.S. military as was done in a much bigger form with 58,000 dead in Vietnam. You can't put soldiers in this environment, in a Muslim country, for heaven's sakes, and expect them to come home and say, oh, we did a great job. When you talk to, up to the rank of colonel, when you talk to the soldiers in Iraq, they'll say what you and I are saying this morning. After the rank of colonel, when you meet the generals or the generals in Pentagon, they're still going along with the Bush line. They've got big careers to make. But below
that,
that
was the same in
happening.
Vietnam. That's exactly the
I'm not quite old enough for Vietnam.
But still, it leaves you with this awful feeling in the political context, is that because our opposition was so feckless and they bought into it, now as they're trying to have the debate that they should have had before they went into the war. I mean, we still have.
No, you're not allowed to have the debate. That's the whole point. No, the Bush administration is saying it's unpatriotic. You're damaging the morale of our men, even though the soldiers in Iraq agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. I know, but I think that the debate's going to happen no matter what, because it's becoming, the political battle lines are being drawn here. And of course,
I notice how we've forgotten about Abu Ghraib. The shame of Abu Ghraib has disappeared off the screen, hasn't it? Have you noticed that? We're back to, are we being defeated or not, rather than what are we doing to our prisoners?
Well, it's pretty amazing to see our government, particularly our vice president, being an advocate for torture. And it takes John McCain, who himself was tortured, to stand up and get the Senate to vote 90-9. To go back to the Geneva Convention, and then even then, Cheney's running around trying to get the CIA exempt, and of course the CIA basically saying, "Well, we don't really want to be exempt." You know, we don't think
the
it
irony
works.
Here, by the way, the irony here, and it applied to the original pictures of Abu Ghraib, just as it applies now to the whole thing about the CIA getting exemption or not, is that the Iraqis are not surprised at this at all. They're not worried about the pictures that are coming out on Abu Ghraib. They never were. They assume that's how we behaved anyway. Right. All Cheney and Bush are doing is proving it's true.
Well, Robert, just in closing, just push us ahead a year. Before the 06 election.
Yeah, my crystal ball broke about 2 decades ago.
All right, but let's give us a scenario of what it's going to look like just before the 06 elections.
The Americans will still be in Iraq, unfortunately, for the Iraqis. We'll have very serious civil unrest in various areas of the Middle East, possibly involving Jordan, quite possibly involving Syria. It all depends on how Bush responds and how soon the real world enters the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department. At the moment, it's not there. Right. Nothing Condoleezza Rice says, nothing George Bush says, nothing Dick Cheney says, nothing Donald Rumsfeld says bears any relation to what I, as a correspondent, see in Iraq. It doesn't bear any relation to the Middle East I live in. At all.
Right. So we've basically got, you know, I've always thought that about Condoleezza Rice, that she's an academic. She doesn't have any real world experience. And she works off political science models and not reality. But the rest of them are also, because of their ideology and their faith-based delusions, aren't dealing with reality. So we're flying blind.
I think that Condoleezza Rice once described herself in Congress as a student of institutional change. Only she missed out on the Iraqi version.
Right. Well, she's a specialist in two countries that no longer exist, the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia. I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Robert Fisk, and for your new book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, which is a seriously thick tome. So people get their money's worth here.
That's a good clip at 1,000 pages, isn't it?
It is. And you really, I mean, I guess the irony about civilization is, given our conversation today, I don't know what we brought. We brought chaos and ruin and pain and
suffering. The irony is that the title, The Great War for Civilization, comes from what was written on the back of my father's First World War 1914-18 medal.
Oh, I see.
And he believed he was fighting the Great War for Civilization when that war ended in 1918 and the victors created the modern Middle East, which we now have today as the greatest tragedy in that part of the hemisphere.
And that was the war to end all wars.
Yeah, indeed.
And it didn't last too long. I thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. You're speaking then with Robert Fisk, the author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer.